From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There's a dual authority in the country. There's one authority representing the reactionary and evil and criminal policies of this administration. And then there's the authority of people who love and yearn for justice and peace and human rights.
Damu Smith is founder of Black Voices for Peace. He's fought war and racism for decades. Now he's fighting for his life. He has colon cancer. Today, a look at racial disparities in healthcare. We'll also have a debate on Vital, a new heart drug approved specifically for African Americans. But first, a look at the ongoing food crisis in Niger.
We have a full-blown emergency in Niger. Children are dying from hunger. It was all predictable.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. King Fahd of Saudi Arabia has died at the age of 84. His half-brother, Crown Prince Abdullah, had been named as his successor. Fahd had been Saudi Arabia's ruler since 1982, though he delegated much of his power a decade ago to the Crown Prince after he suffered a stroke. King Fahd had close relations with Washington. In 1990, Fahd allowed the Pentagon to station hundreds of thousands of troops in Saudi Arabia ahead of the first Gulf War. The move was heavily criticized by many inside the Saudi kingdom, including Osama bin Laden. At the same time, analysts say Fahd helped fuel the rise of Islamic extremism by making multiple concessions to hardliners, hoping to boost his Islamist credentials. Meanwhile, in Africa, the newly sworn-in vice president of Sudan has died in a helicopter crash. John Garang died along with 13 others. Garang's a former leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. Earlier this year, he signed a deal to end Africa's longest civil war. Just 3 weeks ago, he was sworn in as vice president. On that day, he said, quote, "My presence here today in Khartoum is a true signal that war is over." UN officials are reporting that following the announcement of Garang's death, bloody street clashes erupted between Christian and Arab groups in Khartoum. In Iraq, the head of a committee drawing up the country's new constitution announced today the new charter will be completed by its August 15th deadline. A leaked draft of the constitution indicates it may call for Islam to be the main source of Iraqi law and the official religion of the state. Women's groups in Iraq have expressed fear they might lose many rights they've held for decades in Iraq. Investigators in Britain and Italy are now questioning 21 people in connection with the failed July 21st bombings. One of the men, Osman Hussein, was arrested in Italy and has admitted to being one of the would-be bombers. He's expected to be extradited to Britain. The Italian newspaper La Repubblica is reporting Hussein told investigators the bombings were motivated by anger over Iraq rather than religious reasons. Hussein told interrogators, quote, "More than pray, we used to discuss work, politics, the war in Iraq. Mukhtar always had new films on the war in Iraq. He used to show us specifically those where women and children were being killed and exterminated by British and American soldiers, and also of widows, mothers, and daughters that cry," he said. Meanwhile, in this country, a former CIA officer has sued the agency, claiming he was wrongly fired for questioning the agency's view that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. In 2001, a year before the Iraq invasion, the officer reported an informant told him that Iraq had abandoned its uranium enrichment program. However, the CIA officer charges the agency never shared the information with other agencies or with senior policymakers. The officer, who'd worked for 20 years at the agency, was fired last year. His attorney compared his case to that of Valerie Plame, the CIA operative who was outed after her husband, Joseph Wilson, questioned the Bush administration's claim that Iraq was trying to buy yellowcake uranium from the African nation of Niger. The former CIA officer's lawyer, Roy Krieger, said, quote, "In both cases, officials brought unwelcome information on WMD in the period prior to the Iraq invasion, and retribution followed." Former President Jimmy Carter has called the Iraq War, quote, "unnecessary and unjust," and criticized the Bush administration for its handling of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Speaking at an international Baptist convention in Britain, Carter said, quote, "I think what's going on in Guantanamo Bay and other places is a disgrace to the USA." He went on to say, quote, "I wouldn't say it's the cause of terrorism, but it's given impetus and excuses to potential terrorists to lash out at our country and justify their despicable acts." In other news on Guantanamo, the New York Times is reporting two government prosecutors complained last year that the military commissions being set up to try detainees are little more than kangaroo courts. The prosecutors complain the trial system is being secretly arranged to improve the chance of conviction and to deprive defendants of material that could prove their innocence. According to the Times, the prosecutors allege the chief prosecutor had told his subordinates that the first four defendants members were tried by the military commission would be hand-picked to ensure that all would be convicted. Meanwhile, Newsweek has obtained a leaked FBI memo that questions the legality of the Bush administration's policy of extraordinary rendition, where the government transports individuals and sends them to foreign countries that practice torture. The memo was written 3 years ago by the FBI supervisor then assigned to Guantanamo. In the memo, the FBI agent wrote that sending detainees to such countries that practice torture would be in violation of the U.S. torture statute. Newsweek reports intelligence officials are now estimating more than 100 individuals have been rendered to foreign countries by the CIA since September 11th. The Bush administration is taking new steps to help take down Fidel Castro's government in Cuba. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has named Caleb McCary to fill a new post called the Cuba Transition Coordinator. According to Rice, McCary's job duty will be to, quote, accelerate the demise of Castro's government. Meanwhile, Roger Noriega has resigned as Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs. His resignation comes one day after McCary was picked to be the administration new point person on Cuba. Noriega had been one of the Bush administration's fiercest critics of Cuba and Venezuela. In other news on Cuba, a group of 130 U.S. residents are scheduled to return to the United States today after visiting Cuba on a trip to deliver tons of humanitarian aid and hurricane relief. The visit was organized by Pastors for Peace and the Venceremos Brigade. Members of the delegation could now face arrest when they try to cross into Texas. This is Benny Massey, one of the members of the delegation.
We feel that this is unjust, inhumane, incorrect, and unconstitutional. So we're doing this, we're going to do this travel challenge in order to assert what we believe is our constitutional right to travel to Cuba.
A new scandal is hitting the Catholic Church, this time in Toledo, Ohio. The Toledo Blade is reporting that police in the city helped the local Catholic diocese cover up sex abuse allegations for several decades by refusing to investigate or arrest priests suspected of molesting children. The paper based its report on interviews with former officers and a review of court and diocese records. One former police chief reportedly had an unwritten rule that priests could not be arrested. And a new Justice Department report has found there were at least 8,000 reported incidents of rape, sexual abuse, or sexual harassment inside U.S. prisons and jails last year. And the department acknowledged the actual number of incidents could be much higher. Nearly 42% of the reported allegations of sexual violence involve staff sexual misconduct toward prisoners. Meanwhile, 37% involved non-consensual sexual acts by prisoners and fellow prisoners. The report marks the first time the Justice Department has issued a statistical report on prison rape. And those are some of the headlines. Now to today's top story. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country. We're broadcasting on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, as well as public access and PBS stations. We're also video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. We're on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV. We're also on DirecTV, channel 375. We are podcasting at democracynow.org. As well, we have our headlines translated into Spanish at democracynow.org. There you can also sign up for our headlines daily, and you can get our media alerts there as well. So go to democracynow.org, visit Democracy Now!'s website. The African country of Niger is rarely mentioned in this country. One of the few times we have heard it, well, it's been in relation to the Wilson-Plame-Rove scandal, that the CIA sent former Ambassador Joseph Wilson to Niger to investigate claims that Saddam Hussein has sought to buy uranium from that country. The claim proved not to be true, even though President Bush did say it in his State of the Union address. But the fact is, the African country, for a long time, has been facing a crisis, an immense crisis of its own. In Niger, 3.3 million people, including almost a million children, are facing starvation after a drought and locusts wiped out last year's harvest. It's listed as the second least developed country in the world by the United Nations Development Program. More than a quarter of Niger's children die before their fifth birthday. Jan Egeland, UN's Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, said the emergency could have been prevented.
We have a full-blown emergency in Niger. Children are dying from hunger. It was all predictable. The government, and we appealed in November of last year, again in March, and we had a huge flash appeal, as we call it, in mid-May. I met with all of the donors here in New York on the 13th of May, and only now, these days in mid-July, when the images come on television of dying, starving children, do we receive the funding we need.
That was Jan Egeland, a senior UN official. In the last few days, the United Nations has more than doubled the number of people it plans to feed in Niger. The UN World Food Program announced it'll now aim to provide emergency rations to 2.5 million people. Last week, the agency's stated goal was 1.2 million. Relief workers on the ground say the UN and other agencies should have started the large-scale emergency food aid much earlier. Development agencies have criticized the world media for not bringing attention to the crisis, despite numerous efforts from these agencies to get the stories in newspapers and on TV. The chief executive of the Disaster Emergency Committee, Brendan Gormley, told Scotland's Sunday Herald, quote, "The whole push of G8 and Live 8 was to get away from chronic images of African starvation, and Niger didn't fit. It risked falling in the old Africa. The public and politicians aren't looking because of the emphasis on reaching a long-term resolve for Africa. Sadly, people are hungry now." We're joined on the phone by Johannes Sekenes, who is in Niamey, Niger, the capital, head of Doctors Without Borders mission in Niger. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you describe the latest, what is happening in Niger today?
Well, the situation in Niger today is that the number of new admissions to Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders feeding centers around the country is going up. We are now admitting around over 1,000 severely malnourished children a week. Since 1st of January, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has admitted over 15,000 severely malnourished children. Now, the situation in the villages today is getting worse because we know that the coming month is the most difficult month of the year for two reasons. Number one is that it is the last month just before the next harvest, meaning that the very small food stores, or if any, are running out quickly now. Secondly, it is because we are in the rainy season now, which means more diseases for these little ones, diseases like diarrhea and malaria.
Can you describe how the situation came to this point in Niger?
Yes, in the beginning of your program, you talked about locust and bad harvest. Yes, that is one or two of the problems, but one of the biggest problems why the situation is so bad today in Niger for these little children is the late response from the international community. the response given to this crisis in the beginning of this year from the international community was to reinforce the normal development programs ongoing for several years. That was not a correct, adequate response to a nutritional crisis. Food aid should have been set in for free much earlier. Today, the aid that is coming into the country is, for many of these children, already too late. They've already died.
Can you explain what Doctors Without Borders is doing and how aid actually does not only come into the country, but actually get distributed?
Yes. Doctors Without Borders has, since the beginning of the year, since we saw the number of admissions in the feeding center we had at the time go up and double and triple compared to last year, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has increased its capacity to take care of severely malnourished children. Doctors Without Borders is also distributing free food rations, family rations, to families of severely malnourished children and moderately malnourished children in the two affected areas of regions of Maradi and Tawa in Niger. And Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is also offering free medical consultations to the children under five in order to give a response, an emergency humanitarian response to this crisis. Doctors Without Borders has been responding to the crisis since the beginning of the year.
What about the crisis going even beyond the borders of Niger to Nigeria, to Mali, to Burkina Faso?
Yes. I am the head of mission for Médecins Sans Frontières in Niger. Of course, it's the Niger situation that I know the best, but of course I also have messages and I have the information that the situation is going, there is crisis is going on in the neighboring countries as well, in the whole Sahel area. The problem comes back to, I think, for those areas as well, is the non-reaction from the international community. Today, yes, the international community has reacted, but too late. These reactions and the aid should have come in much earlier. That is one of the reasons why the situation now is so bad. We could have prevented this.
We're talking to Yohanna Sekenes in Niamey, Niger, in the capital of Niger. Is this also related to global warming in the sense of the desertification of the country, the growing area of desert?
I'm not sure. I don't have any information on that.
Well, finally, what people can do in the United States? What do you think is the most effective way people can help?
What is important now is that international donors and international community see over its development strategies and have plans for such kind of crisis and not ignore these crises in the future. The review of the development strategies must be done to include more humanitarian emergency aid.
Yohanna Sekenes, thank you very much for being with us, head of mission for Doctors Without Borders in the country of Niger. And we'll put all contact information on our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Shut the window. Fela Kuti, Africa, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In June, the Food and Drug Administration approved the drug Bidyl to treat heart failure in black patients. It's the first time ever a medication has been targeted to a specific racial group. On July 5th, Nitromed, Inc., the maker of Bidyl, began stocking pharmacies and doctors' sample closets. It hired 195 new salespeople to begin making calls on 10,000 selected physicians in Philadelphia, Atlanta, New York, Washington, and other cities with large African-American populations. African-Americans suffer from heart failure at almost twice the rate of whites. Nitromed expects Bidyl to be prescribed to between 10 and 15% of African-Americans with congestive heart failure, who number between 250,000 and 750,000 nationwide. But many have criticized this race-based approach to drug making and marketing. They ask how Bidyl will affect society's understanding of the cardiovascular health of African Americans and whether it'll detract from focus on systemic issues like socioeconomic status, residential patterns of segregation, diet, and stress from discrimination. Joining us on the phone from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Jonathan Kahn. He's a law professor at Hamline University. His article, How a Drug Becomes Ethnic, Law, Commerce, and the Production of Racial Categories in Medicine, was published in the Yale Journal of Health Policy, Law, and Ethics last year. We're also joined on the telephone by Dr. Paul Underwood, president of the Association of Black Cardiologists. The organization was a co-sponsor of the clinical trials for Bidyl. Well, let's begin with Dr. Underwood. Can you talk about what Bidyl is and why it's been approved just for African Americans?
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. Bidyl is a drug that is used for treating heart failure patients, people who have moderate to moderate severe heart failure. It's an adjunctive therapy that's added on top of the standard therapy that's used, which would include the ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, as well as usually diuretics. And it's a combination product with hydralazine and isosorbide nitrate, or basically nitroglycerin. The way that the drug was developed is that data was examined initially from some heart failure trials that were performed in the 70s and 80s, the Veterans Heart Failure Trials. And in that small group of African Americans that were included in the trial, it seemed as if this medicine combination was beneficial. And the African American Heart Failure Trial was then designed to study the use of this drug in African Americans who have heart failure. And lo and behold, it did seem to be very effective. Using this data, the sponsor, or Nitromed, went to the FDA and asked to get the drug approved for use. I believe that since the drug was really studied and shown to be most beneficial in African Americans, that's why it was approved for use in African Americans, and thus the first race-based medicine that was approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
Jonathan Kahn, professor at Hamline University School of Law, what is your problem with the approval of Bidyl for African Americans?
Well, I think it's a good thing that Bidyl was approved, but as you say, I have a big problem with it having been approved in a race-specific manner. There are a couple of issues here. The first thing is that the trials that produced the data that were the basis for the FDA approval, the AHEFT trials they're called, were only conducted, as Dr. Underwood said, in African-American subjects. So there's no basis for saying whether Bidyl works better or differently in African-Americans than anybody else. It was simply done in one group. There was no comparison. Now, for me, at root, what this does is it sends a very troubling message. And that message is that the fact of the matter is most of the drugs out on the market today were tested in populations that were almost exclusively white. But we don't call them white drugs just because the subjects happen to be white. The operating assumption was that for the purposes of drug approval, testing a drug in a white person meant that you were just testing it in a human being. And I think the same assumption should go for when you're testing a drug in a predominantly black population. The idea being that just because it was testing the population that happened to be African American doesn't mean that it's not good enough for everybody else. The idea being that a drug tested in a white population is good enough for everybody, a drug tested in a black population should be understood to be good for everybody as well.
Dr. Paul Underwood, your response?
Well, certainly those statements were very true, that it was only studied in African Americans in the African American Heart Failure Trial. However, this drug combination was used in the Veterans Heart Failure Trial in predominantly white patients, and that's when the first inclination that this drug may be more effective in African Americans became true. And what we found over time, particularly in looking at heart failure, is that there may be some nuances of an individual's response as well as of a drug's benefit. Say, looking at ACE inhibitors, they may be effective at perhaps higher doses or may be necessary to treat African Americans. Or perhaps African Americans who were treated with ACE inhibitors may actually have more of a certain side effects than the white population. And it's only through study with trials such as AHEFT or looking at trials of overall individuals that we're able to tease out some of these nuances. Likewise, I believe that when we look at a trial that's designed such as the AHEFT trial, we're able to learn more about certain mechanisms of heart failure, and it could be that the etiology, the cause of heart failure in African Americans and whites is different, and that's why the drug's action is different. There likely isn't anything specific about the drug combination, the hydroxyzine isosorbate nitrate, that makes it useful in people who have darker skin. But it could be that hypertension, high blood pressure, is more of a factor in heart failure in African Americans than is coronary artery disease, which seems to be more commonly associated with heart failure in whites. And
I agree with completely.
Jonathan Kahn.
Oh, sorry. But then if that's the case, I think that's the way that you design a trial, or that's the way you seek indications based on a medical condition. For instance, that, you know, heart failure with hypertension is a precursor. That's fine, because plenty of people, regardless of race, have that condition. Race is a terribly crude surrogate in this regard. And so I ask myself, when you get the very reasonable comments that you just made about the, you know, different causes of heart failure, I ask myself, why doesn't a company like Nitromed design a drug trial to test for an actual medical condition rather than something basing it on something like race?
But I think that the VHEP trial really didn't show the same benefit, say this trend toward improvement in all hypertensive patients, and it was predominantly in the African Americans that this trend for benefit was seen.
Well, but it's important to keep in mind that in the VHEF trials, not to get sort of overly technical in this, that there were only 49 African Americans actually on the Bidil combination in that trial. And
Jonathan Kahn.
In discussing the trial, what happened in the story of Bidil is it did come for FDA approval in 1996. It was brought to the FDA for approval initially as a drug to treat heart failure in everybody, because some of the same cardiologists who were involved in AHEF believed after these trials in the 80s, they said, this simply is good to treat heart failure in everybody. And so they brought it to the FDA as a drug to treat heart failure in everybody. And the FDA did not approve the application at that point. But they didn't approve it because they didn't find that it didn't work. What they found is that the statistics were too much of a muddle. You know, it was very technical questions, but they just said, we can't tell whether it works or not based on these statistics. And in fact, most of the cardiologists on the FDA review panel were saying, we give this drug to our heart failure patients, regardless of race. We just give it to them because we all think it works. Clinically, we believe it works. Back in the 90s, they were saying this. But just the statistics you've given us aren't good enough for approval, so go back to the drawing board, do a follow-up trial, and we'll think of it again. So then it comes back to, why design a follow-up trial based on race? And this is a critical component here, because it's important to understand, as a background to all of this, the commercial imperatives involved in shaping the science. There are two key patents to Bidil that Nitromed, the corporate sponsor, holds. One is a patent to use the drug to treat heart failure in people regardless of race. That patent expires in 2 years, in 2007. But in the year 2000, they got a second patent, which was essentially the same as the first patent, but it said this drug will be used to treat heart failure in, and then they add on, an African-American patient. That patent extends until the year 2020. And so it provides an incredible incentive to design a trial that's not looking at, say, hypertension as a precursor to heart failure, but to design a drug that will get FDA approval in a race-specific manner in order to protect their patent rights, not in order to get the best indication for the science. And that's one of my deep concerns here.
Yes. Well, certainly I'm...
Dr. Underwood.
What drives Nitromed in seeking the patent applications is something that's a little bit away from how we view treating patients as a cardiologist. Now, the combination of the hydrolyzed nitrosorbide and nitrate has actually been approved and is on the guidelines for use in those people, and all people who have heart failure, particularly if they are intolerant of the ACE inhibitors. So that combination has certainly been in use since the mid-80s and standard, and is considered part of standard therapy, although it's not quite as effective as an ACE inhibitor. It is used in treating patients who are intolerant of ACE inhibitors. The use of the race-specific or the indication for the patent for African-Americans is certainly one that the sponsor, Nitromed, chose based on looking at the data and anticipating the results of the African-American heart failure trial.
Well, I mean...
Jonathan
again,
Kahn of Hamline University.
I basically agree, but then I think, again, in terms of why seeking the race-specific indication when, you know, everybody on the AHEF, everybody involved, all the cardiologists involved in this, all say, of course this drug will work in non-African-American people. Nobody makes the claim it won't work in non-African-Americans. There is a potential that it might work in a higher proportion of self-identified African-Americans than in self-identified Caucasian Americans, but probably for the reason that you say is African-Americans have more hypertension than whites do. Things of that sort, but nobody says this will only work in blacks. And so the question is, why not get it out to everybody? And for me, the only answer I see there is because of trying to make more money off of the drug. And of course, you know, I mean, drug companies, you know, they make money. There's always a balance between commerce and science in developing drugs. That's how our system works. I just feel in the case of Bidil, the balance has gotten way out of whack to the point where it's actually skewing the science and sending these very unfortunate and potentially dangerous messages about African-Americans being sort of genetically different from other people, which is just wrong. And that's my broader concern about this. I think it's great the drug's on the market, but the way it's come onto the market has a lot of very troubling implications.
Right. Well, I think that
Dr. Underwood.
There's no implication at all that the genetics has anything to do with Bidil's mechanism of action. In fact, there's no claim that there's genetics at all. I believe that race in the United States is a social construct, not really a genetic construct. And even though I believe that they're looking at some genetic data, that data hasn't been released or analyzed. This is really just looking at a group of individuals who seem to have a higher propensity toward heart failure and more severe ramifications of heart failure. And certainly if a drug is effective in treating this group that has a higher death rate and seems to have a higher prevalence of heart failure, then likely it would be useful in treating the general population as well. And it's fortunate that we have the opportunity to use a drug and to perhaps learn more about some of the nuances of heart failure, perhaps and even looking at etiologies such as hypertension versus coronary artery disease, that we will perhaps learn more and be more effective in treating patients. And perhaps the drug will be indicated in the future for a larger population. Certainly, I think that it would be in the manufacturer, Nitromed's best interest to try to open up the indication so that it could be used in all individuals who have heart failure.
Finally, Jonathan Kahn, Nitromed will make a lot of money combining two generics, the two generics that make up Bidil.
Yes, well, it's, again, important to keep in mind that these two drugs, as you say, are generics that have been on the market for decades. It's estimated that they cost, a combined form for the generics would cost about 25 to 30 cents a dose. Nitromed has just priced this drug at $1.80 a dose. So that's about a sevenfold increase over the generics. And so they have priced this not as a matter of how much it costs them to bring to the market, but how much they think the market will bear, how much they'll be able to get from insurance companies. And they therefore have also placed it out of the reach of anybody with heart failure who doesn't happen to be African American, because while they might be able to get a prescription for it, they won't be able to get their insurance companies to cover it.
Well, on that note, we're going to move on to our next segment, which is related, but we will continue to look at this story. I want to thank Jonathan Kahn, professor of law at Hamline University in St. Paul, and Dr. Paul Underwood, president of the Association of Black Cardiologists. Thank you both for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we continue today to look at the issue of race and medicine in the United States, now through the eyes of one man, Damu Smith, a pillar of the peace and anti-racism movements in the United States. He's founder of Black Voices for Peace and the National Black Environmental Justice Network. He hosts the program Spirit in Action on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. He was a key leader in the anti-apartheid movement, fought police brutality in Washington, D.C., and around the country. Now Damu is fighting another battle for his own life. He was in the occupied territories earlier this year for a peace march when he collapsed and was taken to a hospital. Doctors there found polyps on his colon and a tumor in his liver. He then came back to this country where he is being treated. Damu is 53 years old. He has a 12-year-old daughter. This year, the American College of Gastroenterology issued new guidelines urging African Americans to be screened for colon cancer, beginning at the age of 45, earlier than other people. African Americans have the highest rates of mortality from heart failure, cancer, and AIDS out of any racial or ethnic group in the United States. People of color face lower overall quality of health services than white people and lack access to routine medical care. Damu Smith is using both natural and pharmaceutical medications to fight the cancer and told the Washington Post, quote, "I'm going to be the poster child for twice a year screenings." We're joined in Washington, D.C. by Damu Smith. We'll talk about his years of activism and his battle today for his own life. We'll also speak with Dr. Joseph Pettencourt, an expert on racial disparities in healthcare. But first, we go to an excerpt of a speech Damu gave recently at Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. It was on the day of the inaugural of President Bush. This is Damu Smith.
Yesterday, I watched the president in his inauguration speech mention freedom 20-plus times. The day before, I heard his stone-faced, reactionary nominee for Secretary of State, Ms. Condoleezza, speak so incessantly about the issue of torture. George Bush doesn't know anything about freedom. Hello. Because he's not hearing the cries of the Haitian people. He's not hearing the cries of the Palestinian people who live under the boot of Israel's brutal and barbaric and racist occupation of the Palestinian people. He does not hear the cries of the Iraqi people. He does not hear the cries of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. He does not hear the cries of the people in the Congo, where the United States policy over so many years created the division in that country that we're seeing right now. I didn't hear him talk about the people in the far region of the Sudan. I didn't hear him talk about the people in the ghettos and barrios of America. I didn't hear him talk about the working people of our country who don't have a living wage and don't have health care. I didn't hear him talk about our youth who are dying in our streets and our children who are going hungry every day. I didn't hear him talk about any of these things. He knows nothing about freedom. We know everything about freedom. We are the moral authority of our nation. Our responsibility is to be the other voice and the other authority, because there's a dual authority in the country. There's one authority representing the reactionary and evil and criminal policies of this administration. And then there's the authority of people who love and yearn for justice and peace and human rights.
Damu Smith, speaking at Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C., after the inauguration of George W. Bush this past January. When we come back from our break, Damu joins us live in our studio in Washington. Stay with us.
Consider it done by the prophet the rage.
What the people say?
Yo, Grip, you and S1W, get to the east side. We got to kick it for the east side, G.
I roll with the punches so I survive. I survive. Try to rock cause it keeps the crowd alive. Crowd I'm alive. Not falling, I'm just calling. But I'm past the days of yes, y'all in. I wiggle round, around, I pump, you jump up. Hear my words, my verbs again.
Do stuff, do
I've been
stuff.
Around a while, you can't describe my sound. Clear the way for the prophet the rage.
What the people say?
Until I got feeling,
feeling.
Just peace at least cause I want it.
Want it
so bad,
so
that
bad.
I'm starving.
Starving,
I'm like Garvey.
Starving.
So can you see B? It's
see.
Like that, I'm like that. Leave me the
Public house. Enemy. Chuck D is 45 years old today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Longtime peace activist Damu Smith joins us today in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Damu.
Oh, thank you so much, Amy. I'm so happy to be here this morning.
It's great to have you with us. So you collapsed in the occupied territories, went to the hospital there. They sent you back here, and you learned from doctors you had little time to live, 3 to 6 weeks. Is that right?
Well, according to one of the doctors that evaluated me at a local hospital here in Washington, people who have my advanced stage of colon cancer, which is stage 4 colorectal cancer, which with metastasis in my liver, people in that statistical category, he said, have 3 to 6 months to live. I heard this information from the doctor and made a decision right then that was an unacceptable death sentence for me, and I've been fighting to make sure that I live, and that means getting the best quality care, both from the conventional healthcare treatment centers, as well as from complementary alternative healthcare practitioners who are much more hopeful and much more holistic in their view of what it means to treat these kinds of catastrophic illnesses.
Damu, when you first heard here about your prognosis, about your diagnosis, colon cancer, 4th stage, what was your response as you moved from the world of the healthy into over that divide so quickly?
Well, the news hit me like I'm sure it hits anyone, like a ton of bricks in my belly. I had to really be still for a moment in the emergency room at the hospital and say to myself, excuse me, what did this all mean? And my life paraded before me like a video before my eyes. And I made a decision again on the spot. I've got to fight. I've got to fight to live. But in the process of fighting to live myself, I want to walk this path and this journey publicly, because I don't want anyone to go through what I'm going through. It's very important for people to understand that this is a life-threatening disease. 150,000 people each year are diagnosed with colorectal cancer. Approximately 60,000 of those people will die from the disease if they don't get the early screening. And African Americans and other people of color die disproportionately from this cancer as well as other cancers. So I want to walk this journey publicly so that other people similarly situated can have a fighting chance. But that means not just talking about going to the doctor to get early screening. That's important. It's fundamental. But also, we have to address the public policy issues associated with the possibility of getting screened. You can tell people to go get screened, but colonoscopies cost money, from $700 to $900 every time you go. People who are uninsured, and that's 44 million people in this country, 40 million partially insured, 64 million people in this country who are in health jeopardy because they don't have access to some form of health insurance. We're talking about a situation where people don't have the possibility of getting screened. So we can't just talk about getting screened. We have to talk about how we can organize and protest and raise the fundamental public policy issues, including the need for national, comprehensive, universal health care. And that's what the Spirit of Hope campaign, which has been mobilized around my situation, is doing, to raise these issues of universal access and racial disparities in the healthcare system. And so this fight is not only Damu Smith's fight, but it is the fight of all Americans who are concerned about racial disparities and access to healthcare in this country.
Damu, how can you afford to have the treatment that you're getting? By the way, can you talk about where are you being treated?
I'm being treated at several places.
No problem.
Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, the Sidney Cramo Cancer Center. I'm at the National Integrated Health Institute in Washington, Dr. Sakaliba Mines, Dr. Allison Henderson here in Washington, Dr. James Davis. I'm at the Sign of Jonah getting acupuncture treatment. So I'm getting treatment from a variety of sources, as I mentioned. I'm having to reach into the toolbox of healing using all the tools that are there to help me because, again, I am facing a serious threat to my life. And so I'm able to do all of these things right now because of the generosity of family and friends who have rallied to my cause. I want to publicly thank Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Danny Glover, who hosted the national tribute and fundraiser to me here in Washington on Saturday, July 9th, where 1,000 people from around the nation and the Washington area came together to pay tribute to me and to raise money, but also to raise these issues that I've talked about on this broadcast, the need to have access to health care. We had a health fair just prior to that event. So we're not just talking about Damu Smith again. We're talking about the need for health justice for all. And that is also linked to the issue of our nation's priorities, Amy. We can't talk about health justice unless we talk about the war in Iraq. Why? Because we're talking about $400 billion being spent on war and occupation when people in this country don't have fundamental access to health care. Billions of dollars being spent on research and development for space weapons, for nuclear weapons technology. Dr. King said that when a nation focuses on these kinds of things, our priorities are out of whack. So we have to connect all of the dots here. And that's what we did in Washington, D.C. on July 9th.
We're talking to Damu Smith in Washington, D.C. And we're also on the line with scientists from Boston, Joseph Betancourt. An initiative launched last month by Boston Mayor Thomas Menino will address racial disparities in healthcare head-on. The Boston-sponsored study found that black men in Boston die on average 5 years sooner than white men. African-Americans are twice as likely, African-American men, to die from diabetes, 4 times more likely to contract HIV. The new initiative will funnel $1 million into detailed tracking of racial differences in patient care and cultural awareness training for healthcare providers. Joseph Betancourt, a senior scientist at the Institute for Health Policy at Massachusetts General Hospital, was part of the panel for the Institute of Medicine that published Unequal Treatment, a study examining racial disparities in healthcare. He worked closely with Boston to develop the initiative addressing healthcare inequality. Thanks for joining us along with Damu Smith in Washington, Dr. Betancourt.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me, and I just want to thank Damu Smith, and it's a real honor to be on the phone with him, and I am with him in his struggle, and I thank him for what he's doing.
Thank you so much.
Well, can you tell us, Dr. Betancourt, what it is that you found and the picture that Damu is describing, how he fits into this?
Sure. Well, you know, unfortunately, Damu's story is not unique. I'd say it's probably the rule rather than the exception. It's the issue of disparities in health, racial disparities in health, have been a longstanding problem that really emerged from many of the very troubling issues of this nation's history. And so it should be no surprise that we see these disparities in health, and it's a major problem, I think, that's getting a growing attention. I participated in the Institute of Medicine report entitled Unequal Treatment that was released in 2002. Clearly, we did in no way discover disparities. These disparities have been around for a long, long time. And I think I just want to differentiate two issues. One, the issue of disparities in health, which is the fact that African Americans and minorities tend to be overrepresented among those who suffer from chronic diseases and other illnesses such as cancer, diabetes, asthma, HIV, for a whole set of reasons. And one of them that was already mentioned here is the issue of access. Minorities tend to be overrepresented also among the uninsured. So you can imagine without insurance, you really don't stand a very good chance of doing well when you have a chronic condition, when you need health promotion and disease prevention screenings, when you need advanced treatments, you're at a significant disadvantage. It's also apparent that clearly the social context in which many of our minorities live in this nation, suffering from environmental hazards, living in environments that are unsafe, not benefiting from the best we have to offer in terms of education, being in the lower socioeconomic ranks, all those things clearly impact our health and contribute to disparities in health. But the other issue that we studied in our report is that even when you have insurance, and even if we were able to provide, which I think is a absolute goal for this nation, to make sure that every American has health care insurance, even if we were able to provide that, we still see that if two people come to the emergency room and one is white and one is a minority, there's a greater chance that the minority patient will receive a lower quality of care. Again, even with the same level of insurance as their white counterpart, same level of education, for a whole set of reasons. And I think that was what we put on the table in unequal treatment. And so I think it's important to understand that disparities in health are a very large problem. Disparities in health care are one piece of the problem, but a very important piece. But clearly, if we're going to ever eliminate disparities in health in this nation, we need to do more about the social context and the social and general policies by which we live in this nation. We also need to do more by way of access, and then we also need to do more by way of improving the way health care is delivered to all of our patients.
Damu Smith, when you are at Johns Hopkins getting your treatment, do you have discussions with the doctors about issues like universal health care?
Well, absolutely, because, for example, there's a procedure called a PET scan, which provides doctors with a closer look at the metabolic chemistry of tumors. And that PET scan at Johns Hopkins cost $4,975. As part of a health treatment plan, if you don't have health insurance in that situation, and your doctor is saying that you need that, you simply won't have it. And I was actually told by someone associated with the hospital who asked me, did I have that money to put up front for the radiologist? And I said, well, no, I don't. That person said to me, well, you probably really could just skip it if you had to and not have it as part of your treatment plan. And this is my first real intimate interaction with the healthcare system, Amy. I've never faced this kind of situation before. I've lived a healthy lifestyle. I've never been confined to a hospital for any reason. So while I've been talking about this issue for years, I am now interfacing with the U.S. healthcare system on a much more intimate level. And I'm learning about the kinds of things that everyday people face all the time. It's a disgrace that, again, that we live in a country where people have to face these kinds of obstacles to quality care.
It's also at a time you have to take on the system at a time when you're sick. And this is what people, I guess, find all the time.
Yes. And it's very time-consuming to have to do that. I've been blessed in the sense that I've been able to have a wonderful network of friends and family, literally from around the world and around the country and in the Washington metropolitan area, who have come to my support. But most people don't have this kind of support, Amy, and it's very difficult. So again, I'm on a campaign, not just for Damu Smith, but for everybody similarly situated. And when I mentioned the issue of environmental justice, when the doctor talked about the quality of life factors, this is very important because people of color are disproportionately exposed to sources of pollution and conditions of environmental degradation, which affects the health and safety of our community. So we come in sicker when we come to the emergency room or in contact with doctors, and usually we're coming later because we are uninsured, that is, people of color. So this is a very serious issue.
In fact, Damu, I think I first met you more than 20 years ago in Baton Rouge, Louisiana,
when
you were speaking at an environmental racism conference talking about communities of color and where, for example, oil refineries are placed.
Absolutely. In the region called Cancer Alley between Baton Rouge and New Orleans along the Mississippi River, there are scores of impoverished, mostly African-American and poor communities living in close proximity to oil refineries, plastic production facilities, and literally 7 days a week, nearly 24 hours a day, those communities are being rained on with some of the worst toxins and chemicals imaginable. So people are very, very sick. Children in those communities miss school because they have high rates of asthma and other severe respiratory problems. And there are very high rates of cancer in that region of the country and in other parts of the country where people of color and poor and working class people are disproportionately exposed to sources of pollution.
Damu, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, where are you in your chemo regimen, your chemotherapy, and how do you get by during those periods when you're taking chemotherapy?
Well, I'm supposed to be on a 6-month chemotherapy regimen. As I mentioned, I'm also receiving complementary alternative medicine with IV infusions of vitamin C and other minerals. I'm taking supplements. I'm doing breath work, acupuncture, and getting herbal treatments. So that's where I am. I'm happy to announce, Amy, that there's been a 40% reduction in the size of my tumors in my colon and in the lesions in my liver. So I am making progress, but I'm not out of the woods and I'm not out of the loop. And people can go to the website www.damusmith.org to find out more about what's happening with me, or call 202-265-4919, or write the Spirit of Hope number 2 at yahoo.com to get more information about what's happening with me.
And Damu, we'll put all that contact information on our website at democracynow.org. Damu, thank you very much for joining us. Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, and we're going to check back with you soon, have you back on Democracy Now! And see how you're doing as we look at how the nation is doing as well. Also, Dr. Joseph Betancourt, thank you for being with us from Massachusetts General Hospital. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Dokadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Neil Geiser. Maddie Harper, Susie Salome. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.